Howdy, y'all. You're listening to the Managing Up Show. I'm Travis Weisgood. I am joined by my co-hosts, Brendan Hayes and Nick Means. And we have a couple of special guests today. I'm going to let them introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Sean Massa. I'm the CTO of Flash Recruit, and we're building chat-based job board software, which is pretty exciting. And just excited to be here.
And I'm Chuck Kowalki. I'm a principal, as in pal, not I am principled, engineer at a company called Popular Pays.
Awesome. So the reason that we wanted to talk with you all today is we know that you have been doing a lot of research with engineering ladders, and it's something that's come up in our prior episodes where we've been talking about trying to grow people, and engineering ladders are a core part of that. And y'all have done a fair amount of research with it. And Sean, I wanted to ask you, first and foremost, what is an engineering ladder and what are you doing to learn more about them?
Sure. Like an engineering ladder, in my opinion, has like two real purposes. One is to help you figure out, how do I advance from like an organizational or hierarchical perspective through this organization? Like, how do I get promoted to a manager or a director, or if there are different paths like that, like how do we get there? And then on the other side, it's how do I improve in the skill set that I have and become a better engineer and a better engineer and a better engineer time after time and get rewarded and recognized for that. So I think they're those two primary goals of a ladder, and sometimes they get mixed and sometimes they're separate, but that's where I see that.
So what happens if there isn't an engineering ladder somewhere? What's the problem with not having one?
So for me, the main issue with not having a ladder is the same issue as not having a defined process anywhere in an organization, right? Like whether you define a process or not, you have a process for almost everything. And defined processes just tend to be better because they're understood, they're explicit, you can talk through what works well and what doesn't work well on them. So a ladder is just a set of defined processes for advancement, as opposed to an unset set of processes for advancement. And an unset set of processes for advancement means everyone's advancing in ways that may or may not be aligned with what an organization ends up needing. So you get people who grow a ton, but perhaps in areas that the organization doesn't need, and then they feel, you know, bummed when they don't get promotions or advancement because they've grown a ton, just not in ways that the organization happens to think are valuable.
So what do y'all normally consider as part of the rungs of the ladder? Is it all just technical? Do you look at things beyond technical? How do you come to agreement on how you move through that, the various processes?
Yeah, I think it depends on what the goal of your ladder is. It doesn't even have to have rungs. Like, some ladders are like skill point systems that you add up to a number and then the number means different things, or the breakdown of that number across different skills means different things. So it's really varied. Part of us looking into this and researching is trying to figure out how do they vary and why. And it really seems to come back to this idea of what does the company value from an organizational perspective and how the company is structured and how work gets done, but also from an individual perspective and how people advance in their skill sets.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about how, you know, this is not a like quote unquote solved problem in the industry. Like, there's not one ladder to rule them all, and there probably never will be. I think like a ladder is in many ways a reflection of the culture that creates it. So I think it's like appropriate that every organization comes up with a ladder that uniquely reflects what they value in terms of culture and skill levels. A thing that could absolutely exist would be, you know, a framework or a set of tools for figuring out like what are the answers to those questions for your organization.
But the core question that we didn't answer yet is, does it focus purely on technical or go beyond that? I think it definitely goes beyond that. Like, something that a company should value is your technical ability, certainly, if we're talking with an engineer's perspective, but also how do you collaborate? How do you write? Like, technical writing is an extremely important skill in the industry, and something that we don't talk about or practice as much, but especially on remote teams, as those become more and more important, like those types of things matter a lot. Yeah.
So like at my company, Popular Pays, we came up with a ladder, and there's like four or five categories. Really only two are technical. The other are about, you know, more of the hard but soft skills. So we have maturity, leadership, and influence are like skill areas that we think people need to grow into advance at our company. And a lot of ways that's a reflection of us being a much smaller company where like everyone can have influence and in fact to succeed needs to have influence in the organization. Whereas in a larger company, you might say like, you know, roll all of those up into communication or whatever and focus much more on someone's technical aptitude, because until they play a role like director or engineering manager, you know, the opportunity for influence and the need for influence or the need for, you know, maturity maybe are lesser just because, you know, you're primarily focused on shipping code.
So you mentioned something that's interesting to me, and I wanted to ask Nick about this. Engineering ladders are there to sort of surface how far a person has leveled up in various areas that are relevant to the business. How do you think it would be different, or how has it been different for you in remote teams versus on-site teams that work together? Is it different, or is it exactly the same? Is like Skype and Hangout skills on the list somewhere?
Gosh, I hope not. You know, in my experience, I don't know that it necessarily needs to be a lot different. I think it takes more empathy to communicate in a remote organization, but I don't know that there's any difference in the required communication skills. You need to be just as skilled in writing and speaking and meeting. You may shift more communication asynchronous in a distributed organization, but that's going to happen in any organization as it grows. The bigger it is, the more async things have to be.
Are you saying that the value is similar to the business, or that the requirements are similar, like of that skill?
I think it's true both ways. I think that you're required to be just as good a communicator in a co-located environment as you are a remote environment. The communication pathways may look different, but you still have to be a good communicator to be effective in both environments.
When you say good communicator, like in a remote versus sort of more co-located place, do you think the like points of what describes a good communicator are the same, or would they be different to reflect the different needs of a different style of org?
They might skew a little bit more towards written or asynchronous in a distributed organization. But I think, you know, as you move up the ladder towards senior engineer, towards principal engineer, you're probably going to see a need to start documenting architectural decisions and writing things down anyway. So I don't know that there's a whole lot of difference there.
Okay, so I wanted to ask some questions of Sean. You've researched this a fair amount. Categorically speaking, are there categories that wind up being thematically similar from organization to organization, or are they just completely all over the map?
Oh, there are lots of similarities for sure. Like that's one of the main points of interest in looking at the collection. So I've collected, I think it's 41 different career ladders. A lot of them are very public. Most of them are actually public somewhere. So I'll just do searches once in a while, or when they come up, I add them to the list. And there are a lot of similarities. They care about the same kinds of things, like scope of impact, technical expertise to different degrees and different definitions, but obviously that's still there. Communication is a big one. Showing leadership qualities is a big one.
I remember we started collecting these when, so Sean and I both worked at Groupon, and we started collecting these when we were still there. And I remember getting, so Groupon had a ladder, and I remember receiving one from a friend who was at Square. And it was like, oh, like, I know plagiarism when I see it. Like, not straight copying, but, like, there was, like, certain phrases or categories that were just, like, identical. Like, I feel like you could almost trace back to some Ur ladder somewhere, you know, generated deep in the bowels of Amazon or Microsoft somewhere.
Oh, definitely. Like, you can see that when people share their ladders publicly, it's usually with a blog post that says, I saw Rent the Runway release their ladder, and then I based mine off of that, which I think is totally fine, but it's really interesting to, I think you really could trace those back.
Yeah, when I was looking at these online, trying to source ideas for, you know, improving our engineering ladder, I really struggled to find clear common themes among them in terms of the types of traits or how levels actually worked. Some just said, here's a list of things that we expect. Some said, here are, you know, categories or specific traits we expect people to level up at. Do you have any examples of certain types of traits that you, in your engineering ladder, if you're building one, what are you looking for?
So I went through this process at a previous company. We went from very organic growth to being 150 engineers and realizing, wait, there's no clear thing that defines an SE3. So we needed to come up with clear definitions for all the various roles we had, and then how you moved beyond those and what that looked like, whether that was moving into something like a staff engineer or a principal engineer, or into architecture, or into some sort of leadership role. So in that ladder that we created, we ended up with a two-part focus. As you came in as an associate engineer or an SE1, moving up the ladder was much more technically focused. It was get your technical chops about you. And then as you moved up in the organization, it became less about technical and much more about the softer skills. Things like communication, things like leadership, the ability to have influence. These were all things that as you moved up were expected. And if you wanted to move out of an IC role into an architect role or into a manager role, they were things that were expected of you. Those were the key things to work on.
An interesting take I heard from Sarah May at RubyConf this last weekend was the idea of using sort of a spider graph for these things when you talk about levels, because there are so many different points that you could possibly be on that you could have strong and weak points that might balance each other out, or you might have one point that's super strong, but it's not enough to balance other things out. And so sort of a measurement of the area of a spider type chart. I don't know if you've seen one of those before that looks like a spider web, for lack of a better way to describe it. As a way to sort of understand somebody's general sense of progress in their career along your ladder.
It's interesting, like the two large sort of analyses systems are essentially like your level is so like a ladder with levels defined and a set of descriptions of what matches that ladder. And in organizations, it seems like the rule is generally like you must pass this post in every category to be considered a level 4. And then other systems will have more like, it's a grab bag, a more of a point system, and your level is basically defined by you've reached a certain number of points, and maybe you've done that through focusing solely on technical expertise, and you know, maybe your communication's not that great, but like you're so technically advanced that like it sort of makes up for that skill, or vice versa. And like we happen to have one that's more point-based. And I think for us, that reflects we have a lot of people who are coming into programming as their second career. And so are sort of technically would be a little lower on the ladder at perhaps a larger org, but like knock it out of the park in terms of communication, influence, maturity. Because, you know, they've had a period, you know, they're 35 years old and they've been programming for 2 years, but they have all those other skills that they've built up in, you know, years and years and years of being a mostly functioning and responsible adult that affect their job and career in really positive ways. And like we wanted to recognize that at least in our organization. But I've been at places where it's the opposite, where it's like you're super mature and an excellent communicator, but only level 2 of technical skills. Level 2 is, you know, that's sort of gating you at that level.
Yeah, these things remind me of wasn't there like a Japanese game show where you have to put your body in a specific configuration and there's a wall coming towards you and you have to fit exactly that hole? Like that reminds me of the really strict ladder systems that you see. Like you have to be exactly this.
I have seen ladders that have specific technical, you know, SQL knowledge at a certain level that you are able to perform certain specific technologies. Is that too granular, or have you seen that work before?
I think it is too granular. Like in the ladders that I've worked on, I tried not to mention specific technologies at all because I'd rather it be some way to more vaguely describe your proficiency with the technologies you happen to use and then use the same like engineering ladder for all of the engineers, for example.
A common problem, at least in web technologies, which I think is less true now, but was certainly very prevalent, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, was many web companies would start out mostly backend developers. So let's say Rails as an example of a backend technology, and really design their levels around the specific skills of a backend technologist. And then, you know, like front-end people who are mostly focused HTML, CSS, and JavaScript had trouble meeting those. And then at some point, like in my opinion, the complexity of those two worlds kind of flipped. And you'd have very talented people working in web UIs getting dinged constantly on a ladder system because, like, you know, well, they don't know SQL. They're not amazing at database modeling. But, like, those are the definitions of what a level 4 is like you've done these things that are like very backend focused, and to flip that, if you evaluated the backend people by sort of JavaScript skills, or, you know, like, do you consider human factors? What do you know about accessibility? Have you thought about how to internationalize this? You would find the, you know, by that set of criteria, the backend engineers would be, you know, barely treading water. So like I mentioning, like, I think you either, as Sean said, like, stick away from mentioning particular technologies and let people make a case of like, you know, these things I do demonstrate this criteria, or you end up with a series of like very specific ladders that are more role based. You might have like a front end engineer ladder, back end engineer ladder, you know, a prod ops engineer ladder. A risk there obviously is for people that play multiple roles. Let's say you're a full stack developer, or you used to be you know, an SRE engineer, but you know enough back end stuff. Like, if you're on one of those ladders, do you just miss out on valuable evaluation of the other skills you have? And in large organizations, I would say, like, yes, like, you get evaluated by your primary job, and your extra skills can often fall by the wayside, which is a bummer that they don't get recognized.
So that was one of the things that we tried to address with our ladder. We had front-end engineers, software engineers, and the split was essentially like full stack or back end or software engineers. And if you are a front end engineer, you are on the front end track. And then it just jumps straight into architect. And it'd be like, well, we don't expect a front end engineer that could be a UI architect to be able to jump in and debug database queries. The same way I don't expect somebody that has a lot of database experience to be able to jump in and debug a memory leak in Chrome. Like, those are just two different skill sets. And we tried really hard to abstract away specific technology focuses from the latter. And it might be that you are contributing to open source projects, regardless of what those projects were, or running an open source project at a certain level. And then we moved the technical competency into sort of a sidetrack. So it was almost like a matrix. You could say, okay, so for our front-end engineers, that's a technical competency. You're an SE3 that focuses on front-end engineering, or an SE2 that focuses on front-end and back-end because you're doing full stack. So we expect both of these. And that seemed to work really well for us and really liberated the process, because we kept trying to like, okay, well, what do we add for a front end? Okay, well, what do we add for a back end? And it gets into where you're trying to balance it. And by pulling that out as something entirely separate, that really helped us come up with a ladder, and really forced us, when we started talking about technical competency, to be to future-proof the ladder in a way that we wouldn't have if we would have just focused on the tech stack that we had at the time.
Yeah, I think whatever approach you take, and there are a couple, to make your to reward people for having different shapes of their skill sets, like, the better off you are, the more future-proof you are, the more inclusive you'll be. It's really just a better result.
So the big question for me is, you can define the type of engineer you want at various levels. I think that requires some hard thinking, and I love that you're doing research on this, and I hope that we can bring more of an open source mentality to this. The second half of this is, to me, the hard part, and that's assessment. How do you make concrete, or reasonably concrete and non-subjective, assessments of people hitting their marks on these levels? Do you have ideas or thoughts on that?
Concrete, I mean, so we have a pretty extensive peer review system, I think, indicative of like how flat our hierarchy is. So for us, it's mostly right now you identify ahead of time who you'd like to review you and what areas you're working on. And hopefully, like, someone is sort of like noticing and guiding along the way. So for example, if I said, I'm, you know, maturity level 3 and I'd like to get to maturity level 4, I'm going to select Sean and Travis to sort of watch my back on those and give me feedback about how I'm doing. And then at the end of an evaluation period, you know, deliver a summary, and that summary goes into my full review. So like, I think that's like a way to make it thorough. I don't know how to make it like qualitative, right? Like, I don't know if you could say like, well, geez, we were really hoping you would communicate effectively 42 times this quarter, but only 38. And so you're just not getting that promo you were shooting for. That's tough, right?
Maybe that's not a useful goal, the quantification aspect of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe instead of asking how do you make it concrete and quantitative, how do you reduce bias when you are making the qualitative judgments?
Yeah, I agree that we can't get past the qualitative nature of this and maybe with a lot of research and throwaway work, we can get to a point where we'd have more data about that. But we know that like counting lines of code or something is not a good idea. So in that qualitative world, we really do have to recognize the biases that we have, scope the decisions to as small as possible so that an error in any one of them is small. And when you add it up, hopefully the drift is small. But it's tough. Like, no one wants to go through and spend 4 hours evaluating one person come review time either. So there needs to be a balance somewhere. I think part of it comes from thinking hard about what those criteria should be and making sure there's enough of them and they're very focused and there's examples of what good is in that case, but also that there's a lot of continuous feedback. It's also not, I mean, people throw up the straw man argument of we don't want to review once a year. Like, yeah, lots of people agree with that now. But it just should be something more continuous that we're following up with on one-on-ones that other people know the things you're working on, like other members of your team, and they feel encouraged and it's part of the team culture to give you feedback on those things. On my team, we have public goals. Like, everyone on the team knows that I'm working on the skill and that person's working on that skill to try and help facilitate more of that continuous feedback. And I think all those things put together will help control that a little bit, but also recognize that you're never going to do it completely. Like, that's impossible.
Even the definition of a ladder is like in its heart qualitative, right? Like, if you're saying, you know, maturity of level 2 represents the following things, like, you've already made qualitative judgments about maturity, about how to demonstrate that, what amount of maturity is demonstrated by certain things. Like, there's no escaping, unfortunately, the qualitative nature, even of things that you can count, right? You could say, a very senior engineer must have done 300 commits. Says nothing about the quality of those commits or, you know, areas they've neglected to make sure they're doing commits. There's qualitative nature to all of this stuff.
Yeah, if engineers understood clearly the actual quantitative business value we generated, we'd work on commission.
I think one other point that's important to make is that, yeah, while the career ladder stuff gets kind of soft and squishy and it's hard to get our hands wrapped around it, I feel like the worst career ladder is probably less biased than an ad hoc process that's undefined.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's at the very least, even if it is biased, like, you know the bias going into it and can adjust your behavior. The worst is like a secret Santa review process where, like, you find out at the end of a year, here's the things you should have had been working on if only you had known the whole time. Like, well, I would have done different stuff. Like, what, you can't decide how you're evaluating me on my behavior after I've already done the behavior without telling me. Like, that's just ultimately unfair.
And the other thing I want to point out, and I realize the irony of this on a podcast with five white guys on it, but having a diverse team and having diverse set of experiences and backgrounds and, you know, different ethnographic profiles you asked earlier, Nick, how do you fight bias? Well, people with different backgrounds, like, we have people from different backgrounds on my team, and they point stuff out to me that are in my blind spot. They are not shy about it. And they're saying, hey, I'm making contributions in ways that are not really being recognized in our ladder. And then we go change the ladder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that's an important thing to point out in terms of the benefit of diversity, is that it begets more inclusiveness.
Yeah, I think that's a critical point. When you're, like, if you're part of the creating an engineering ladder at your company, it seems really common to pull in like all the senior leadership or whatever it is to figure out what those things should be. But at a lot of places, that's just a bunch of white guys. And you need to pull in more people than that. People of different backgrounds, people of different skill sets, people of different current positions, because they're going to have feedback about those things too.
When we were doing our ladder, which is only at this point about 9 months old, over half the people involved had their tenure at the company was like under 6 months. Like, we almost specifically biased towards people new to the company, figuring like they had a sort of greener and fresher sense of like what the company was now compared to the people who've been there for 2 years, 3 years. They may come up with a ladder that reflects what was valuable when they started instead of what is valuable to the company in the moment today.
So how have you all guarded against the ladders becoming a thing that, for lack of a better word, the engineers try to game? If you give people, here's a list of things that you need to do, and it turns into the, okay, well, I'm going to mark off all of those things. You mentioned earlier the you have to have X number of commits, and it doesn't say what's in those commits. I'm thinking of like the unit tests I see that just load a file so that they get the 100% test coverage kind of thing. So how do you guard against that?
I don't know that you can. I mean, the problem with all incentive structures is that you change behavior. So you have to be very careful about how you're defining what behaviors you want people to engage in. And also be careful to not neglect in behaviors that you consider sort of standard or like you get these for free, right? Like if you designed a ladder that didn't have anything about communication and people optimized for everything except communication, like what you've done is you've incentivized people to be poor communicators, which, you know, ultimately is not doing those individuals, your team or your company any favors. I don't know if there's a great way to guard against that.
Well, I think that is the guard. Like, it's, I don't think the question was, how do we prevent this from happening entirely? It was, how do we combat it? And that is what you do. Like, you think about it. What incentives are we putting in place here? And what should we do if someone does do that? So Medium put out their growth framework, and in the blog posts about it, they described how it works. It's more of a skill point system, which is really fascinating. I definitely encourage everyone to go and look at it because it's one of the most thorough skill point career ladders that I've seen put in place. But in their blog post, they even talked about this, like, what do we do if someone games the system? Because the way it's set up is there are these 16 tracks, and gaining level one at any one of those skill tracks is much easier than gaining level five. So they were worried that some people would want to go and get level one in all the tracks. And there are a lot of different skills related to that. But in the blog post, they mentioned it's structured so that's still a good thing. Like, that's still beneficial to the company. We recognize that that can happen. And if someone does that, good for them, because we want them to do better at all those things. They said that all 16 of those things are equally valuable. And if anyone wants to improve in any one of them, that's great.
So what if we incentivize our people to be better and then they go do it?
Oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's easy to get into foul territory with this stuff too, though. I think this came up last time we talked about career ladders, the colloquial story about Microsoft and there being a level on their career ladder years ago that required you to have presided over a reorganization before you could get to that level. And so what did Microsoft have a lot of? Reorgs.
Yeah.
And it's a very valid skill because in a big organization like Microsoft, you need people that know how to do reorgs.
Yeah, getting levels on anything is I wouldn't say a bad idea, but I think you should know what you're doing and communicate that to people. So at a previous place, to move to level, I don't know, four, there was a requirement that you essentially led a large project, which is cool. But not every, you know, team needs a new large project. There's only so many new large projects you get. And what ended up happening at that company is you had a number of people, a lot of people, getting to the point where like they could perform at a level four level, but you couldn't promote them because they couldn't have this item ticked and there was no alternative. And I don't know if it was intentional or not. I suspect it was, but essentially that's just a gating mechanism. And if you're being honest with your coworkers, you would just say like, I 100% believe you could perform at a level four level. There's just not that opportunity here. We simply don't have an opening for another level four engineer. So you either can be happy growing in other areas, but not getting promoted, or let's get you to a place where your skills are going to shine in a better way, which, you know, obviously if you're taking a very negative capitalist view of the world, like you would never do that, right? Like keep that person who is growing on your team for as long as possible because you are getting more and more value at a better value out of them and never let them leave ever.
And the gates, like you can still have them if it's really important to your business, like the reorg thing. Like if you want someone to be good at that, maybe it's a separate role you work someone towards, or maybe it is a gate, but then you should also have some alternative. So the requirement is either you led a large reorg and that was great, or you did this other thing that's analogous in some way and can also satisfy this requirement.
It's interesting. There's a lot of, so I have friends and coworkers that are ex-Googlers, and they share around many tweets going on right now that are essentially answering the question like, why is the current Gmail so bad? And the answer, I don't know if you've seen, is essentially like, you get promoted for launching products, including redesigns and rewrites. And so you've incentivized rewrites. And one comment in one of these, like, you know, anonymous Reddit threads I was reading was, you know, guess how many important bug fixes it takes to get promoted? An infinite amount, because those are not incentivized whatsoever. And so you have a system where people write the current Gmail, which I do not like, to be really bad, slow, and buggy. And all the engineers who are going to come afterwards and fix that will not get promoted, despite the fact that, like, the person that caused that problem probably is, you know, sitting in a corner office, or probably not because it's, you know, Google, sitting in the least noisy place of the giant open office.
So we touched on something a little bit earlier about how to ensure that you are measuring the right things. And I'm curious for y'all's experience of validating your ladder. Trek, you said you just worked on one within the last 9 months. Once you got that first draft, I would assume it's gone through some revision. What was that process like?
It hasn't yet. So we put it up into an internal GitHub repo and are treating it very much like code review. So kind of everyone can propose a change. It does need to have enough people saying, like, yeah, that reflects things. And we have some guards against, because of how we do sort of, you know, your reviewers and they know what you're working on. There's sort of a window that closes for making changes. So we never want to end up in a world where, 3 weeks before it's time to turn reviews in, we've changed the evaluation criteria. But right now it's mostly just up to us. And I don't, which reflects kind of, I think, the fact that we have a smaller organization, pretty flat hierarchy. And I don't know that we've really proposed all that many changes. Not that we got it perfect, but, you know, we've done essentially one round of reviews with it. So it's hard to say whether it, like, reflects us or not. I suspect, like, as the organization lives on and grows over time, the rate of change will probably go up as, like, you know, the ladder needs to change to reflect to what the org has turned into over time.
Yeah, you describing the everything changing right at the last minute kind of reminds me of that law that was passed a handful of years ago that senators and House reps can only vote on the next guy's salary increase, so they couldn't vote themselves a raise.
Nice.
So in terms of coming up with your own engineering ladder, one thought that I stole, and I don't know where I stole it from. I think it was, I had a conversation with a guy named Alan Werfsbrock, and he talked to me about the engineering ladders they used to use at big companies, you know, 40 years ago, 45 years ago when he was getting started. So the ladder went, in terms of incremental improvement and leveling, it went in every category all the way up until it hit, had industry level impact in X, had industry level impact in Y. And I think that's actually a really great anchoring mechanism for trying to come up with your own engineering ladder to say, okay, well, we know what zero is. We know that zero is you're not qualified to do any job here. And the top end is you are impacting the industry and all the categories that we're talking about, and using that as a way to sort of shade in levels in between there somehow at whatever, you know, gradations you think are appropriate. That's something I've been trying to think about and do in our engineering ladders. And I'm wondering if there are other things other techniques or other things that you do to try to come up with ways of seeing levels, or are there people, do you have like personas that you use to think about, oh, this is a person that clearly demonstrates senior? Like, how do you actually come up with the set of criteria that represent senior to you and staff level or principal level?
Well, we just copied Medium.
That's a good start.
You know, we're a much smaller org. I don't know that we had any strategies, but I will say a thing we did, and I think I've noticed, is levels tend to be more tighter defined and also more quickly gained at earlier parts of careers, and then get to a point where it's like, you know, you've reached, you know, senior five or whatever, and like, I think most of the ladders are talking about there being just a lot of skills to work on in that area. And so, like, a reasonable expectation would be you're going to get to some level, like principal, and be like, yeah, you're there for 5, 6, 7 years. Whereas I think it's really common to see people move from like engineer one to engineer two in like a 2-year period. In fact, some ladders even have listed number of years of industry experience as not necessarily a requirement, but a, like, typical guidance. I think it's typical to see. And like, you can see the number of years in each bucket, like, goes up over time.
There was one ladder, I forget which one it is, that had one level for every year you're expected to be there and grow. and they had like up to 12, and they said if people ever go beyond that, then they'll add more levels. But the expectation was you're leveling up every year, and if you're not, then that's a clear sign that we need to work harder on something, and then if you're not for a long time, it's a clear sign that maybe you should go elsewhere. I'm not necessarily advocating for that. It seems like a lot more work, but it was definitely interesting.
We had took a kind of different approach with that. We did say that like an associate engineer, or junior engineer to SE1, that we wanted people to do that in 9 months or less. We expected people to do it in a year or less. If you were still an associate engineer a year in, okay, you're not learning fast enough. Maybe this isn't the right place for you. SE1 to SE2 was a couple of years. We expected that. And that was our senior engineer role. And then beyond that, it was staff engineer, distinguished engineer, and so on. But once you got to SE2, the idea was it was perfectly reasonable for somebody to get to that level and say, okay, this aligns with what I want to do in my life right now, is be a senior engineer, and not move beyond that. Obviously you always want people to improve in ways that they, that make them better at their job, but it wasn't you have to get to SE3 in two or three more years, or we're going to be questioning your commitment. We treated SE3 as like, it was the staff engineer, and it was the people that were really dedicated, a combination of real dedication and talent, across a wide array of things, that would get you to that level or into one of the various leadership roles. But we definitely had a point that was like, okay, we're thinking of this as like a bell curve, and the majority of folks are going to be in this middle. And there's some difference between maybe somebody who's just become an SE2 and somebody who's been doing it for 3 or 4 years. But we expect the vast majority of the folks to be in that middle part of the bell curve. We also, as we were evaluating it, we took it as directors, and validated folks on our teams, and then we took it to some of our managers who we picked across the org to have them validated against some of those same people that reported into them as kind of that sanity check. Okay, did we get this right? What did we miss? Are there people that we think are clearly an SE3, but by these criteria wouldn't meet that? Okay, well, that's showing us a hole if we all agree this person is really an SE3, but our system doesn't show that. What changes do we need to make to plug this hole?
We actually came to the same conclusion that we call them different levels. We have software engineer 1 for us is junior, 2 is more mid, and then senior, and then staff. But if somebody's willing to get to what you called SE2 or we call senior, at that point, it's if that's what that person wants to park at, we'll find other ways of growing and promoting them if they're not interested in moving into the staff or principal type role. But if they're not willing to get to that point, or they're not able to by our standards, that's a problem that we have to figure out and work through.
And one of the challenges there is how does this influence compensation, right? Because you could have somebody that decides that they want to be a senior engineer and that's where they want to be, and they stay in that role for years and years and develop a lot of organizational expertise that they should be compensated for, despite the fact that they're not leveling up on the career ladder.
I think the core of this really is the crux of that distinction that we've talked about before, which is it an organizational ladder that tells you how to move into different positions in the company? Or is it a skill ladder that tells you, I have achieved a new level of mastery of programming in this way? And a lot of ladders mix those, and I think that's some of the contention that we're talking about right now. Some ladders don't. It's really just positional with like a tiny bit of leveling, or they go wildly the other way. Like the medium growth framework is much more, this is all skill. Like there are 16 different skills we care about. You get points in them. And then, yeah, maybe to be a project lead, you need to be a level 5 this and at least a level 3 that. But it's not like a clear, strict thing that you have to achieve. And I think that we need to be mindful of that when we're making ladders. Because if we're not, then we'll end up making a ladder, then having to come back to it and do something different or attach something else to it to accommodate for this problem.
And do you have a preference between the two, between positional or skill-based?
I think that something like Medium's framework is pretty great, because I really like caring about individual skills and not saying you necessarily have to meet like this strict line definition, like rungs on a ladder. But the problem with that is, and even Medium's blog posts about it didn't really address this, is how do I really know that achieving level 4 in this skill is worth 9 points on this system. Where does that data come from? What research proves that that value is there? It's just a little too vague.
But well, it's vague because it's specific to Medium, right? Like they culturally defined the values of those things.
Sure.
It's not going to be scientific, and I'm sure it doesn't apply. Well, I mean, it may apply in other organizations, but I wouldn't sort of make it a pat generalization that like the number of points or values they attach to certain things apply everywhere.
I don't think it has to apply everywhere. I don't understand how it applies to them.
Well, that's fair because we don't work in Medium.
Oh, sure.
Someone from Medium, well, I mean, like, excuse me, why are puns? Puns are only 2 points. I disagree.
But if I wanted to reproduce the general structure and change the points or whatever for something that makes sense for our organization, I still don't know how to do that because...
Well, Trek, you made a really good point to that by talking about how these flow sort of naturally from organizational values. Mm-hmm. If your organizational values aren't clearly represented and weighted in your engineering ladder, then it might be worth taking another pass at it and seeing how this pushes individuals toward those organizational values.
I think like when that breaks down in an organization, I think that's a good sign that your ladder reflects a previous culture. Like when you get a bunch of people going, this ladder is not fair. One way to think about it is like, oh, they're just whiny that they're not getting a promotion. But it actually might be an important signal that like this ladder reflects a culture that like doesn't represent the company anymore. Or maybe the company's grown so large it represents one portion of the company, but doesn't accurately represent a different portion of the company. And reconciling all those differences is like, you know, that's why I guess managers get, you know, paid good money and are doing hard work to be like, recognize, hey, this is an incentive structure for a much younger company or a much smaller company or a much bigger company, and knowing when to like tweak these rules to reflect what's going on in the world today.
I think you just hit on something that's almost a future topic for us, and that is the sort of the shifting types of people that you need in organizations as you go from early phase startup to growth startup to established company, and how those are just totally different skill sets depending on where you are as a company and an organization and where you are on your own life cycle. And I think the company ladder could be a way to help you as a manager keep a feel on how things are going. If it starts to feel like this ladder is constraining your team in a particular way, that might be a good early warning sign to say, hey, I need to revisit this. One of the key takeaways I've taken away from this entire conversation comes back to one of the very first answers, and it's the answer that's almost always correct when you're asked something, a technical question in an interview, and it really depends. There's so much that goes into trying to figure this out that you can't just say, oh, here's the one thing that works. You could say, okay, well, here's a whole bunch of things that could possibly work. Some of them are going to work great for you. Some of them are going to fail miserably if you try to implement this inside your company. So I think the work you're doing, Sean, and trying to pull this together and create a list of all these career ladders so folks have a smorgasbord of options to choose from when they're trying to figure this out is really great work. And thank you for doing that.
Sure. And I definitely agree with that. It depends, but I do think we could have better starting points. Like if you... My real goal for this project is to have a list that people could peruse and pluck out the things that they think that they agree with, which is great, but also to synthesize it into some common forms. If you are a small company of a certain size or certain characteristics, then maybe you want to look at these ladders because they're going to be more applicable to that size. And for larger companies, there are different ladders for that size. So I want to get to a point where we have something like that people could use if they wanted.
Like, I don't think, I'm with Sean, I don't think we're going to ever have, like, one true ladder, but a framework for and guidance on how you build the ladder specific to your company at a given point, like, would be very valuable. Not just for people creating ladders, but also for, you know, when a person's interviewing, you could look at a published ladder and be like, these reflect the values of the company and what they think is useful skills, and I can make a good determination of, like, you know what? I'm going to shine there. Like looking at this ladder, that's how I want to grow too. And I'm going to end up being, you know, director someday at this company, or like, I'm going to be stuck at the level they're hiring me at forever because I don't agree with what they consider to be the next highest skill level.
I've actually found our ladder to be an extraordinary recruiting tool.
It's funny. We talk about the interview process. It's, One thing I've not seen done, although Sean and I have talked about it, is incorporating your ladder, not just as a recruiting tool, like Brandon mentioned, but also like as how you do initial placement and discussions around compensation. So essentially, your interview, you can think of your interview as like the first, obviously very lossy because you don't have a ton of data, evaluation of an incoming teammate on this ladder, and sort of where they fit on it. And like if your salary coincides with levels on the ladder, it's very easy to talk about, and very frankly talk about, like, here's the salary we can offer you. And then the discussion in a negotiation of like, I would like to get paid more, which seems to always come up, is less about like, okay, cool, how good are your negotiating abilities, and more like, well, okay, like you want you know, 130k, but that's not what we pay people who are level two, and we think you're a level two. What can we do so that you can demonstrate your level three to justify wanting the extra money?
However, negotiating is worth 5 points on our ladder.
So bravo, so, that bumped you to level three.
Hey, if you're in sales, hell yeah. Like, that's a skill that you want to judge people on. Yeah, that's something that we've, neither Chuck and I have gotten to a point where we've made that part of the process, but we've talked about it as the dream, where your ladder is really the anchor of, like you said before, your company's values, and that's how you should judge it. But also on the other side, on recruiting, it really should be an interview is your first performance assessment. We just haven't worked together yet. So how do we get information about that? Like, oh, we mock up a situation where we work together in this way. And then maybe we call some of your references, not just to say like, hey, what's like working with this person, but like, hey, on this point in my ladder where I don't have extra time in the interview process to evaluate that thing, can you just talk about how good of a communicator they are on remote teams or something like that? And you start to build this structured set of evidence that you can compare against the ladder. And then, yeah, those discussions become a lot easier. It's, I think you're level three at communication, and you think you're level four, and that's going to be important for where we place you. And it also lets you say, sure, maybe we can't come to a shared understanding right now. We disagree. That's fine. What if we brought you on at a level two? We bonus, we give you like a sign-on bonus to sort of bridge that gap, but then by next review period, if you didn't then demonstrate that level, you'll just stay at the lower level until we can get you back up.
Or, you know, trust them. Be like, hey, let's bring you on as the level you think you are. You know you better than we do. But obviously, like, at 6 months when we're ready to do that first evaluation, if that doesn't hold true, like, that's going to be an awkward conversation about, like, you're not really the level that we brought you in on.
I think all of that is really awesome, and it lends some importance to this topic, because if you're a manager and you're working on your hiring and recruiting process and defining your interviews and job descriptions and all that stuff, and you haven't worked on your ladder yet, maybe you should invert that and work on your ladder first and let the hiring process start falling out of
it. I think if you're doing a hiring process and having evaluation of new candidates, like, you have a ladder. It's just not explicit. It exists somewhere, and it's probably not like agreed upon or well understood by your team or other people in the company, but it exists. It's there in some shape. You can, you know, like the scene in Star Wars where you can detect the missing planet by the things orbiting around it. Like, the things you're saying people are good at or bad at as evidence of why they should or shouldn't get a job are those planets orbiting the missing star.
Well, I think with that, we should probably wrap up, but I really enjoyed this conversation with you all, and I really learned a lot about why people should do engineering ladders, how we could get started. I didn't know about the Medium resource, and I really appreciate you sharing that. Sean, if people want to bother you and tell you to get on the ball about putting these resources together, how do they reach you?
Twitter, I'm Endangered Massa there. That's a good place. My DMs are open. If you want to send me your career ladders to add to my collection, private or public, just let me know, and I won't publish the private ones later. That would be great. But yeah, it's Twitter's the best place, and I definitely, like, I'm working on the blog posts and whatnot now. I definitely want to publish these things, at least the public list, and make it a resource for people to use.
Cool. We'll look forward to it. And Trek, what about you?
If you would like to harass me on Twitter, also Endangered Massa, just please send all harassment through Sean. No, I'm Trek, T-R-E-K, on Twitter and almost every horrific social media platform. I'm an early joiner, so I always get my name.
All right. And Nick, you're...
And Means.
As always.
As always.
Means on the Twitter. And I'm Te Viking. And if you can spell that, go for it. We actually have a Twitter account for the show now. So if you want to reach out to us with questions or suggested topics, we're at Managing Up Show on Twitter. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us. Have a great week, and we'll see you again soon.
Puns are one definitely like a level 5. You don't get to principal engineer without being well versed at puns. And hence the principal joke. That's a homonym pun. They're among the funniest and highest level of puns. We're cutting all this out in post, right?
Oh no,
that stays.
Oh, that's.